This week on The Score, could California-type wildfires hit Virginia? What are the true origins of Thanksgiving? Is facial recognition technology a threat to our civil liberties? Will illiberal democracy undermine liberal values? All that and more on The Score. Don't go away.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere. Virginia and neighboring states experienced their first blast of winter weather this past week. Meanwhile, California has been hit by horrendous wildfires that have killed dozens of people and destroyed whole towns. As snow and cold rain fell on Virginia, I spoke with state climatologist Jerry Stenger at UVA. I asked him if Virginia has ever suffered the kind of fires California is enduring right now. One of the big things in the news this week and for the past couple of weeks has been the wildfires in California, which have been devastating with dozens of people killed and whole towns destroyed. Have we ever experienced those kinds of wildfires in Virginia?
We have had some extensive fires in Virginia in some years. They tend to be very unusual here in comparison with out west. There are some forest fires that cover large areas, but not the sort of devastation that we see out in California. The big reason is we don't have a distinct seasonality to precipitation. The normal precip from month to month tends to be relatively the same. Now, in California, most places out west, there's a distinct seasonality to precipitation. So there are distinct dry seasons. These are the ones that give rise to so much of the risk of wildfires. The other problem is that out west, a lot of these locations just simply don't receive as much precipitation as we do here. So there's more of a tendency for the forest floor and debris and fallen trees and such on the forest floor to dry out. And this is what makes the whole thing a tinderbox for the start of wildfires, and it doesn't take very much to cause these things to start up. And there's so many people that are located within these forested areas that get very dry during the dry season. This is what leads to a lot of the destruction and loss of life that we tend not to see here.
And I suppose another difference is that California has those heavy, dry winds blowing in from the west that we simply wouldn't get in Virginia.
Right. Due to the circulation, due to the atmospheric circulation out in California and many places in the west, they will often have these very dry winds that blow in, often known as the Santa Ana winds. These certainly don't help conditions either, because not only do they bring increased dryness, but they can help fan the fires and cause them to increase their intensity.
Now, about 15 years ago, Virginia had a rather lengthy drought. Did that increase the possibility and actuality of fires in any parts of Virginia?
When we talk about drought conditions in Virginia, we're talking about two types of drought. One that's known as a short-term or agricultural drought, where we have a drying of the topsoil layers. Then we have a hydrologic or water supply, long-term drought, which has to do with the lessening of the groundwater conditions. When we have a drying at the surface that is prolonged, the tendency is for the debris on the forest floor to dry out. And that's one of the things that leads to a lot of problems with forest fires. The other thing is that when we have a lot of tree damage from freezing rain, frozen precipitation, lots of limbs coming down. Now, those limbs wind up on the forest floor, and over time, they begin to dry up and decompose. And this increases the amount of tinder on the forest floor. So it's not a case specifically of drought that gives us a higher risk of forest fires, though that certainly does. But it also has to do with the amount of debris on the forest floor that has been able to accumulate over that period of time. And a lot of times that heavy accumulation is one of the biggest causes of some serious forest fires.
It's interesting that you make the point about falling limbs due to rain or snow, which links our winter with precipitation to dry periods in the summer when fires might start. But right now in Virginia, we're experiencing a real wintry mix. In Charlottesville, it's raining, and I've seen pictures from northern Virginia of snow on the ground. That's pretty typical of Virginia in the winter, wide variations in the kind of precipitation we're getting.
Today we have a perfect example of the type of winter precipitation we get here in Virginia. It's very often a mix of precipitation types, or at least very hard to forecast what's going to happen, because we're very often on the borderline between air that's cold enough to produce snow or warm enough to give us just rain. We also have the Blue Ridge Mountain right nearby here in Charlottesville and running through Virginia that allow a layer of cold air to be trapped up against the mountains in many conditions. The Blue Ridge Mountains will allow enough cold air to be trapped up against the mountains to give us a switch in precipitation types. A lot of times what might otherwise be rain will turn over to some sort of frozen precipitation before it hits the ground, or in some cases, freeze right at ground level. And it doesn't take much of a shift in temperature for us to go from 31 degrees to 33 degrees, and the outcome is completely different. And it's not just a case of what's the temperature at the ground level. It has to do with the temperature profile all the way up in the atmosphere. Is there a warm layer aloft? Is it a cold air layer? How deep are these layers? How cold or warm are they? And all of this has to go into making a forecast for the precipitation type that we're going to have. And very often, things only have to shift 20, 30 miles to make a big difference. Here we have a perfect example where for much of the day we've had simply rain here in Charlottesville. But if we go over the other side of the mountains, we can have more frozen precipitation. Go further north up to northern Virginia, and there's more cold air being brought in by the storm that developed off the coast. It has been able to bring a lot of snow to the northeast as it cracks northward. But here in most of Virginia, we didn't have an all-snow event, but we've had various mixes depending upon where you are in the state and exactly when you had to drive over the mountain.
My next question is, given your experience in watching Virginia winters, what kind of outlook do we have for this year? Are there any unusual conditions we should be aware of?
As far as the outlook for the rest of the winter, it turns out that we are in a part of the country, the Mid-Atlantic region, that is notoriously difficult for making these long-range forecasts. It's notoriously difficult for making short-range forecasts, too. Over time, the forecasts have been issued for a season in advance. The Weather Service have done very poorly in this area. It's just a fact that we're on the verge of, or the borderline between warm and cold air, warm and moist air, and as I mentioned before, it doesn't take much of a shift to change things entirely. So as far as what we're expected to see in the upcoming winter, it's really a toss-up. Things can change very quickly, and we can wind up with very different conditions. So for that matter, just use climatology for the most part to figure out what it's going to do this winter, and you'll probably be not too far off But if we had to bet one way or another for what the conditions were going to be like this winter, I would say go spend your money somewhere else. Don't try to guess what it's going to do. and it's hard enough to even figure out if we're going to have above or below normal temperatures, above or below normal precipitation. And when you try to put those two together and figure out how much snowfall you're going to get, you are completely in the dark. So the best answer I have is I don't know.
Well, that's a good answer. Jerry Stenger, thank you for joining us at the last minute. I really appreciate it. I'm going to try to catch up with you in January or February when there's a blizzard in the forecast and we can talk about
weather. There we go. All right. Well, I hope that was helpful, and you take care. Have a good one.
Yes, thanks very much for calling.
Did you miss the previous episode of The Score? Look for our podcast at bearingdrift.com.
Anyone who has attended elementary school in the United States knows the story of the first Thanksgiving. The Pilgrims landed on Plymouth Rock, nearly starved during their first winter, and with the help of local Indians, had a successful harvest that they celebrated with a magnificent feast of turkey, cranberries, sweet potatoes, and corn. Like so many things we know to be true, that story is wrong. Historian Coy Barefoot, executive director of the Albemarle Charlottesville Historical Society, will set us straight. There's an underreported historical story about the origins of Thanksgiving and something of a debate between whether it started in Massachusetts, as the stories go, or somewhere else. Where did it start?
There is no debate. The truth is that the first Thanksgiving in English America was right here in Virginia.
We're talking with Coy Barefoot, who's the executive director of the Albemarle Charlottesville Historical Society, here in his office in downtown Charlottesville. And Coy knows a lot about this. What was the first Thanksgiving in Virginia? Where did it happen? Who did it?
So we're talking about the first Thanksgiving in English America, right?
Right.
It's older in Canada, in English or French Canada. And it's actually even older than that when we do talk about like Spanish Texas.
Uh-huh.
So you can find these actual ceremonies of Thanksgiving well before the one we're talking about. But if we're talking about English America, the British settlers in America, the first real Thanksgiving that we can point to is in Berkeley, at Berkeley Plantation in the Virginia colony. And this was December 4th of 1619, which was a year and 17 days before the Pilgrims ever even landed at Plymouth. So over a year before the Pilgrims got to Plymouth, there were 38 English settlers who arrived in the colony of Virginia, sailed up the James River, and got out at what became Berkeley Plantation. And they had a commercial venture, right, to like Jamestown before it. This was a commercial venture that would encourage immigration to the New World. This was not about religious freedom. This was about planting settlers, which is why it was called a plantation.
Oh, not because they were planting food crops or cotton. They were planting the people there.
Right, to colonize the area.
Uh-huh.
And this was it was called Berkeley Hundred, which becomes Berkeley Plantation. And they had a feast to celebrate their safe arrival in the New World. And not only did they call it Thanksgiving on that day, they actually declared it an annual holiday. This is in Virginia in 1619. And they said, quote, "We ordain that the day of our ship's arrival at the place assigned for plantation in the land of Virginia shall be yearly and perpetually kept holy as a day of thanksgiving to Almighty God." So this is over a year before the Plymouth, before the Pilgrims even got to Plymouth.
So, and this is in Virginia. 2 years before the first Plymouth Thanksgiving.
Right. Yeah, because the Plymouth Thanksgiving is, of course, 1621. And the truth about that, I mean, the book you want to read is called The Times of Their Lives, Life, Love, and Death in Plymouth Colony. And it's James Dietz and his wife and scholar, Patricia Scott Dietz. Came out in 2000. It's the book about Plymouth. If you want to know the real history about Plymouth. And Jim, of course, was one of America's great pioneering historical archaeologists, a friend of mine, finished up his work his career at the University of Virginia, passed away in 2000. And he spent much of his career debunking the myths of Thanksgiving. You know, telling people, hey, the first one was actually in Virginia at Berkeley 100. And what the event that we look to now at Plymouth of 1621, and we call it a Thanksgiving, there is nothing in the historic record of anyone there who even used the word Thanksgiving versus Virginia where they did. And the truth is about that dinner, what they were doing is they were basically, it was a harvest home celebration, quote unquote harvest home, which is an old English celebration where you're celebrating the harvest, right? That's why it's in the fall.
Right.
And they were having a harvest home celebration, which is a very non-religious, secular harvest festival. There were about 150 pilgrims at this event in 1621. And they called it the Harvest Home, not Thanksgiving. It was a big celebratory meal that likely didn't have any turkey. In the historic record, there's mention to fish, lobster, geese, and beer, or what they called strong water. So they would have had beer and you know, not turkey and stuffing. The whole turkey and stuffing and the traditions that we know, that all comes from the last half of the 19th century when Thanksgiving was invented out of whole cloth, and the magazine writer who invented it and got Abraham Lincoln to sign on to it and make it a holiday, she referenced Plymouth as the beginning of this festival. But, you know, she was wrong. That's not what was going on at Plymouth.
And before Lincoln took hold of this, George Washington also declared a day of Thanksgiving, but not in the sense that we celebrate it as a holiday today.
Right. It was actually very common for politicians of the 1790s to declare a day of fasting, a day of prayer, a day of thanks. This was a common thing, mostly among what we would today call the conservative politicians of the era, which of course were the Federalists, Washington, Hamilton, Adams. The more liberal politicians of the day, the Democratic Republicans, your Jeffersons and your Madisons. Jefferson, when he was president, went out of his way to say, I'm not declaring a day of prayer or thanks. That's a private matter. The government shouldn't be telling people to pray. So, you know, but the conservative, just like today, the conservatives of the era were more comfortable doing that, using the power of government to sort of legislate a morality, a religious morality, than the liberals were at the time, just like today.
Now, it may be because of the connection to the Civil War and Abraham Lincoln that the Virginia first Thanksgiving was forgotten or erased. But was it forgotten or was it erased?
Both, probably, right? I mean, but I think it was... It was later in the 20th century, if I'm not mistaken, wasn't it Kennedy who was told about the Virginia Thanksgiving? There was, I can't remember, to be honest, but there was a president in the 20th century who said, oh, wait a minute, we've been wrong all these years. The first Thanksgiving in America was actually in Virginia in 1619 on December 4th, which is, interestingly enough, right about the time when we celebrate it today. And they, again... they called it Thanksgiving, and they named it a holiday in Virginia in 1619.
Now, they called it, they declared it would be an annual holiday. Did they follow up on that? Were there subsequent Thanksgiving?
I don't know. That's a great question. I'm sure there's a PhD scholar out there who's done that research. I don't know. But I think we can assume that at some point it did get lost, because I didn't grow up knowing this.
Right.
I didn't learn this until I was well into my adulthood, that I just came across this information, because we don't know this. We don't know the truth about the pilgrims. They didn't wear black. They wore very colorful clothes. They didn't have buckles on their shoes. they didn't, you know, the truth about the pilgrims is also just packed in myths and stories that for some reason we keep repeating as if they're true, but they're not true. The first Thanksgiving wasn't at Plymouth. They didn't wear black. They weren't eating turkey.
And the pilgrims at Plymouth were not the Puritans who later settled Boston.
Bingo. Very different.
They had a more joie de vivre
right.
than the Puritans did.
Yes.
1619 was a very important year in Virginia history. It's also the year of the first legislative body in what became the United States, the House of Burgesses, and also the year that slaves first arrived. So that was a big time in early Virginia.
Yeah, the longest running representative government in the Western world is right here in Virginia, beginning in 1619. And that legislative body still meets today, the Virginia General Assembly. And then there's the story about the coming of enslaved Africans brought to Jamestown in 1619, very well documented. Again, that's a story sort of like the first that Thanksgiving started at Plymouth. Enslaved peoples existed in the Americas long before that. I mean, it's documented in the historic record of enslaved, even enslaved Africans being brought to Virginia or being brought to the Americas long before 1619.
Certainly the Caribbean and Brazil.
Georgia. Yeah, I mean, they were in Georgia long before Virginia.
Well, but Georgia wasn't a colony until the 18th century.
I think the Spanish were bringing it.
Well, it could have been the Spanish.
Yeah.
There would have been enslaved people in England at that time.
Yeah. And there's something on the record about Native Americans practicing slavery when capturing members of other tribes and enslaving them. So it existed in the Americas long before 1619. 1619 sort of gives you a place, if you want a place to begin the story, to begin the reflection. As a historian, I would just encourage people, don't let that be an end point, right? Don't put everything on 1619. Let that be the doorway to explore human slavery before 1619, after 1619, and even today. Slavery is still alive in America today. There are, as we speak, people who live in slavery in America. Human trafficking.
Yeah, it
still
does exist.
We've just renamed it, but it's human slavery. And there are people who are not in charge of their own bodies and their own lives as we speak.
Well, we're talking right now at the end of 2018, which means next year will be the 400th anniversary of all of these things. What kind of commemorations will we be expecting in terms of the founding of the General Assembly or recognizing the first Thanksgiving next year?
I don't know about that. I know there's been some conversations, certainly, about commemorating the 400th anniversary of representative government in the New World, in English America, and many conversations about how we can use that 400-year anniversary of this documented instance of enslaved human beings being brought to Virginia, using that. And I've been a part of already planning meetings talking about what can we do to open to create opportunities for people to learn more. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the goal, right? It's not prescriptive. I'm not in the business of telling people what to think about history or what to think about a topic. It's about providing information to people so that truths and facts about history can be part of the conversation and people can learn more. I haven't been a part of any conversation about how we can mark this as the true beginning of Thanksgiving in America. I think it should be. I think it absolutely should be.
I bet the people at Berkeley Plantation are thinking about it.
Yes, and I bet the people at Plymouth are like, well, hold on a minute.
Well, we've got to close there. But Coy Barefoot, thanks for talking to us about the origins of Thanksgiving in Virginia and America. And we'll see what happens next year.
Thank you, Rick.
Okay, thanks.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
After a hiatus of a few weeks, The Score's film critic, Tim Halsey, has returned with a review of a new feature called Gosnell. Tim's review might suggest that he sees movies so you don't have to.
Rarely have I seen a film that I admired more or felt more uncomfortable talking about than Gosnell, the trial of America's biggest serial killer, now playing in theaters. Kermit Gosnell, the subject of the film, was a notorious Philadelphia abortionist whose unsanitary clinic and substandard operating procedures placed the lives of hundreds of women in jeopardy, most of them women of color. His trial in 2013 was the first instance of an abortion doctor being placed on trial for murder, which made it a major event for pro-life groups. But for the rest of the country, including mainstream media outlets, the Gosnell trial was almost completely ignored. Photographs taken during the trial show rows of empty press benches, and it was only after a massive outcry from conservative pundits and websites that the trial received any national coverage at all. The film Gosnell is a straightforward Law and Order-style docudrama that follows the case against Gosnell from the initial FBI raid against the clinic in 2010 to Gosnell's conviction 3 years later on counts of first-degree murder, manslaughter, and illegal late-term abortions. Dean Cain, best known as Superman on the Lois and Clark television series, plays Philadelphia Police Detective James Wood, who makes the initial discovery of Gosnell's clinic. Cain is blandly charming in early scenes, grimly resolved in later ones, and provides this film with a few much-needed moments of comic relief. Sarah Jane Morris, another television veteran, plays District Attorney Alexis McGuire, who works with Detective Wood to build a case against Gosnell and put him away for good. In this mix is Disney Channel regular Serena Fialo, as a mysterious blogger who may have the last piece of information the prosecution needs to complete its case. This part of the story, at least, is familiar stuff. What distinguishes Gosnell isn't the courtroom business or the acting, but the content. The film opens with a statement that the events are exact representations drawn from testimony and court documents. Even so, much of what it depicts is so sordid and so extreme that it defies belief. For starters, Gosnell's clinic had cat feces in the hallways and rats in the operating rooms. The few pieces of medical equipment available were either outdated or non-functioning, and Gosnell had untrained interns administering anesthesia to patients. The film asks the question of how such an outrage could have been allowed to continue for so long, and finds its answers in a bureaucracy so anxious to appear pro-choice that it ends up neglecting horrifying conditions in women's health facilities. As Kermit Gosnell, Earl Billings delivers a fascinating performance, alternately self-satisfied and oblivious, concealing monstrous intentions under a benevolent exterior. Midway through the film, when he delivers a full confession of his illegal activity to his attorneys, all under the pretense of fatherly concern, the film Gosnell comes as close as anyone could to exposing the dark heart at the center of the story. Director Nick Searcy, a regular on the recent FX series Justified, doesn't wallow in graphic details, choosing to imply the horrors rather than show them outright. Although Gosnell is much less gory than an average episode of CSI, it nonetheless feels stomach-churningly gruesome as the characters calmly discuss medical practices barbaric enough to boggle the imagination. In one sequence, Gosnell's defense attorney, played by Searcy himself, cross-examines the head doctor at another women's clinic, displaying the kinds of needles used in typical abortion procedures and questioning the doctor about what happens in the rare case of a live birth. The scene is utterly devoid of violence, blood, or harsh language, and yet it is the most difficult thing I've watched in a cinema in years. Gosnell is far from a masterpiece. The filmmaking is low-budget and frequently clumsy, the writing often resorts to easy sloganeering, and Searcy tends to cut to swooping stock footage panoramas of the city of Philadelphia, or worse, to unrelated images of children playing. Too much of Gosnell gives the impression of being a glorified made-for-TV movie, though given the film's budget, that's probably inevitable. What sets Gosnell apart, and even makes it admirable in my view, is that it is one of a very few films that try to demystify abortion, that attempt to talk about the procedure honestly without sugarcoating. If you're pro-life, pro-choice, or simply on the fence about the abortion question, you should see this film.
When The Score comes back after this break, we'll explore the illiberal democracies of Hungary and Brazil and find out whether facial recognition technology threatens the civil liberties of American citizens. Don't go too far. The Score will be right back.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit BearingDrift.com.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm Rick Sincere. Our next guest is Jake Grant, one of the writers and pundits from Young Voices. He recently wrote an article about political developments in Brazil and Hungary, and he fears what will happen to liberal democratic values in those countries and elsewhere around the world. Here's Jake Grant, who has previously been a guest on The Score. What is this concept of illiberal democracy, and where did it come from?
Well, it seems like it's been sprouting up ever since 2016. A lot of these candidates are these far-right people in Brazil or in Hungary and a lot of places all over the world, and they're almost borrowing some of Trump's rhetoric and taking it a little bit further and kind of promoting these anti-immigrant just sort of taking it to the next level.
We're talking with Jake Grant, who's a Young Voices contributor. There's, like you mentioned, this is happening all over the world. I mean, we can look at the Philippines, Duterte, mm-hmm. Hungary, Viktor Orban, Poland, where they've tried to stack the Supreme Court to reduce judicial independence. This is a form of populism, isn't it? And rejecting liberal ideas, and by liberal ideas I mean things like the rule of law, constitutions, economic freedom, free enterprise. Why is this happening now all over the world, including in parts of the United States?
It seems like it's a bit of a rejection from a lot of these governments who have been more left-leaning for a few decades. What just happened in Brazil is directly that. The Labor Party was in rule for almost 15 years, and it seems like people were kind of fed up and wanting to go another direction. And what I've noticed is it seems like people take that in the extreme other direction when they're fed up.
Now, you have been writing about Hungary. Viktor Orban was once a protege of George Soros, who spends billions of dollars around the world promoting civil society, mm-hmm. liberal values. Now Viktor Orban has rejected George Soros and is throwing a university supported by Soros out of the country. What was that transformation?
Yeah, so he was actually part of the uprising back a few decades ago that was going against the communist rule. So he's definitely changed and hardened his stances to be more far right. He's doing some very crazy things. He just won his third term for prime minister back in April. And his party owns something like 90% of the media. He's using that to kind of have this anti-immigration, anti-refugee rhetoric. And it's controlled because a lot of what's going out is put out by his party and by himself.
And Orban even has followers in the United States. Representative Steve King of Iowa has been known to retweet things from Orban, things like diversity is not a good thing. Which is, you know, in complete contradiction of what history has taught us, which is that when cultures meet and mix, it creates progress.
Yes, absolutely. He's definitely taken the rhetoric and taken it very far, especially with the media. And what he's done is he's transformed a lot of the citizens into being so anti-immigration. A lot of the ads they put out, he is going against George Soros and saying that the Muslims are invading our country, and that's why he has so much support from these border cities, is because to them it seems like there's this huge migration crisis because of the media that he controls.
You know, of course, the last time the Muslims invaded Hungary was about 500 years ago, and in that case, the Hungarians won.
Yeah, absolutely.
How much of this illiberal democratic or illiberal non-democratic populism is being financed and pushed by Russia, specifically Putin's political apparatus?
I'm not sure. I know that Orban and Putin definitely have some connections, and I'm sure their policies probably line up a bit. But I think that it's when Orban was first elected again for his second term in 2010, after serving in the late 90s and early 2000s, it was 8 years of this far-left government. And it was one where the economy was not doing well. So when he was elected again in 2010, I think that people thought this would be the change they were looking for, and maybe not necessarily what it's turned into 8 years later.
So in a way, this is a pendulum swing. In Brazil in particular, you've had a left-wing government that's highly corrupt. Mm-hmm. And so the new president who was just elected was running on an anti-corruption, anti-left-wing platform. But he's also illiberal in mm-hmm. many ways. And he has said specifically democracy is a bad thing. And he's had expressed admiration for the military junta that ruled Brazil for decades before democracy started to take root.
Yeah, he has. He said some things that he's kind of the tough on crime candidate, and that's what people kind of liked. They saw that, you know, the murder rate in Brazil is so high, and he's praising the police and telling them they need to be more aggressive and having this that sort of viewpoint. And it's definitely a military type mindset from back when that sort of rule was going on.
Do you think that people like Steve Bannon in the United States are working behind the scenes to help some of these populist wannabe dictators around the world?
I'm not sure. I think in Brazil in particular, they focused a lot on the new president, but didn't focus a lot on the state and federal politics. There's actually quite a few alumni of Students for Liberty that are in Brazil that actually won state elections and federal elections. They're part of the new party. So I think that it's a shift, and the focus has been on the president, but not necessarily on kind of the shift of people going towards more liberty-minded candidates across the country and states.
And in Brazil, its Congress has been very active in providing a check against unbalanced executive actions. It actually impeached one of its presidents recently. Mm-hmm. That kind of led to this change in attitudes about executive power. So would the Congress in Brazil be an effective balance against this kind of illiberal democracy from the top?
I think so. I think that they're moving in that direction, and I think similar to Trump in that he says some things that are free market, are more liberal, but then he goes and says something that's completely the opposite. So I think it'll kind of depend on who he's getting pull from. There's been talk that some of his cabinet is going to be these liberty-minded people. But it'll just be in what direction he's pulled.
And Brazil is one of the largest emerging economies in the world, and it's aligned itself with Russia, South Africa, China, in the BRICS. What will this change in politics have as an effect on this sort of emerging modern economies in countries that only a few years ago were behind the curve?
I'm not sure. I think it'll kind of depend on if he borrows more of the Trump, like sort of protectionist type of rule, or if he goes towards his more free market inclinations, because he's kind of expressed both. He said some bad things about the UN. He said some stuff about Venezuela. So I think it all comes down to kind of who's in his cabinet and who are helping him make those decisions and guiding him in the right direction.
Just to wrap up, let's get back to Hungary. It's in the center of Central Europe. How much of what's going on in Budapest is going to affect or perhaps infect its neighbors? Is Viktor Orban a leader of Central and Eastern Europe today, or is he an outlier?
I think it's hard to tell right now. I think it's going to depend on what he continues doing. I think that there's a lot of people that are starting to realize that he is not a democratic ruler and that he's actually starting to be a lot more authoritarian. So if people continue to start to see this takeover of the media and the exploitation of businesses, things that he's been doing, I don't think it's going to be a good thing. And I think people in the EU and others are starting to see and call him out, and it'll definitely affect the way he rules.
Well, Jake, thank you for joining us on The Score this week. It's a pleasure to talk to you again, and you always got something new to talk about, and I really appreciate that.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com.
The same day I met up with Jake Grant in Washington, I also met Matthew Feeney at the Cato Institute, where he is director of Cato's Project on Emerging Technologies. We talked about how facial recognition technology, aimed at controlling immigration at the borders or facilitating travelers in TSA lines at airports, can adversely affect U.S. citizens by eroding our civil liberties.
Matthew's most recent paper for Cato is titled Walling Off Liberty: How Strict Immigration Enforcement Threatens Privacy and Local Policing.
You're about to publish a paper on the problems that come with the technologies that are applied to immigration policy and how they might adversely affect American citizens. Can you, give us a brief summary of your findings?
Right. I think when many people think of immigration policy, they think about the border and border patrol and enforcement there. But what I'm trying to do in this new paper is to highlight that actually American citizens have a lot to worry about when it comes to the strict enforcement of immigration law and some of the administration's new policies. So that's Americans not only traveling at an airport where they might have their electronics searched without a warrant. It might be Americans who live in the interior who might be stopped by a CBP checkpoint. I'm also in the paper trying to highlight how strict enforcement of immigration laws risks undermining effective policing in places that are called sanctuary jurisdictions, for example.
Okay, we're at the Cato Institute, and I'm talking to Matthew Feeney, who's director of the Project on Emerging Technologies. Over the past few years, libertarians in particular hit on the meme of immigration policy being applied to American citizens with papers, please. But now it seems it might be, may we scan your retina, please. Is that the sort of thing that we should be worrying about?
There is a push from the administration on expanding the use of biometrics. So facial recognition might be one of the technologies that we should be keeping an eye on, because the extent of facial recognition is something I think many Americans aren't aware of. According to researchers at Georgetown, half of American adults are already in some kind of facial recognition database. In the new paper that's coming out, I highlight that the Department of Homeland Security is actively seeking drones with facial recognition capability. And this, I think, should raise all kind of concerns for law-abiding Americans, because this is, of course, being done in the name of immigration enforcement and counterterrorism. But on that, I think we should be very wary of how this kind of technology could be abused in the future, even if you support strict enforcement. Because absent the right kind of regulations, the use of facial recognition is something that government can use for all kind of nefarious operations.
Well, anyone who's used Facebook in the past couple of years has probably had one of those creepy moments when their face is tagged in a photograph that they didn't even know existed. Mm-hmm. What the government could do with that is probably quite nefarious.
Yes, and that's the overriding concern. You can look to other countries to see where this is being really turned up in a country like China. Now, I don't believe that we're anywhere close to the kind of totalitarianism that we see in China. Fortunately, we live in a liberal democratic republic. We don't have to fear that kind of surveillance or tracking. But the technology won't go back in the box it came from once we have another election or a new administration comes in. And a glimpse of the history of American law enforcement and surveillance reveals a long and diverse list of people who have been the target of government surveillance. So when we're thinking about surveillance technologies, we shouldn't be thinking of the end that people will talk about, whether it's immigration enforcement. We should think about the technology and what it could be used for. And that's one of the reasons why I think we should be concerned about all kinds of technologies being used in the name of border enforcement.
And when you think of border enforcement, many Americans are not aware that there's a strip of about 100 miles from every border, every seacoast, that's essentially a constitution-free zone where police can stop you for any reason just to check to see whether you're an illegal immigrant or not.
So within 100 miles of the border, Customs and Border Protection retains the authority to stop a vehicle in order to determine the citizenship or to ask the citizenship of the driver. And 100 miles is a huge area. Two-thirds of the people who live in the United States live within this 100-mile zone. It's a zone that includes entire states such as Florida, most of New England, and some of the most populous cities, of course, down the California coast and parts of Texas. And that, I think, is a worry for many Americans who are just going about their day. And some of the data that I talk about in the paper suggests these border checkpoints are actually more effective at catching Americans who have committed non-immigration violations, so drug offenses, than they are at catching illegal immigrants. And these kind of checkpoints outfitted with the facial recognition drones that Department of Homeland Security is apparently interested in pursuing should concern all law-abiding Americans.
Are there members of Congress who are looking into these types of technological intrusions into the lives of American citizens and putting the brakes on these programs?
Well, when it comes to the search of our property at border crossings or ports of entry like airports, there has been fortunately a bipartisan concern. So in the Senate, you have people like Democratic Ron Wyden and Republican Rand Paul, who are very concerned about those kind of intrusions. They have allies from the left and the right in the House. The worry, though, is Congress these days isn't getting very much done. I don't anticipate that changing at the moment. And despite the fact that the Supreme Court did rule that police need a warrant to search the phone of an arrested person, there is a Fourth Amendment exception when it comes to searches at ports of entry, and a warrant is not required to search electronic devices such as phones and laptops at airports. And what we have seen is an increase in those kind of searches that have affected American citizens, which is very disturbing.
On two levels, how can your average citizen push back against this? First, sort of politically, and second, are there technological fixes that we can have to sort of shield our faces from facial recognition software?
I suppose there are means by which you can try and shield yourself from facial recognition. You could wear a big hat or big sunglasses. There are some jurisdictions where actually you can't wear masks walking around outside. And unfortunately, this is not an option when it comes to travel. We're not at the point where facial scans are mandated for travel. But if they were, that would be regrettable because there wouldn't be a way to opt out if DHS said, no, this is now mandatory.
I saw in one of the articles you wrote that some of this facial recognition technology is being used with the offer to passengers that this is going to speed up your way through TSA. Mm-hmm. You'll be on your plane faster. And, you know, this is something that is attractive to some people, and they may not realize what rights and liberties they're giving up in order to have an expedited time in their travel lines.
Right. As I mentioned, I think in that article, too many people are willing to sacrifice their liberties and on the altar of convenience. And look, I hate TSA lines as much as the next person. Airports are not the most fun places to stand in long lines, but we should be a bit more, I think, wary of being willing to hand over or to subject ourselves to this kind of technology in the name of a shorter time spent in lines.
How much influence do the airlines have in terms of these kinds of policy changes?
So airlines who have partnered with the government in some of this have a degree of flexibility, but ultimately it's the federal government can pass requirements for travel. And so from that perspective, airlines actually don't have much wiggle room. If Congress says in order to operate you must do this, then they're in a position where they can put up their hands and say, sorry, this has been mandated. So ultimately, I think it's Congress that will have to do the heavy lifting. But, you know, ideally, you would have competition. If an airline said, look, we offer shorter queues, but you have to subject yourself to facial recognition, and then other airlines say, no, for us you don't, that would be, I think, preferable to Congress mandating a one-set policy for everyone.
And one way of going in that direction could be to actually privatize the TSA as it was before September 11th.
Sure. Something that's been very interesting in working on in this area and on this paper is finding how short I think some people's memories are, that we now think of the Department of Homeland Security as a permanent feature of our federal government. But it's a post-9/11 invention, and the way that airport security was handled pre-9/11 is not like what we see these days. And there are other options out there.
And aren't there a handful of airports in the United States that do handle security privately, not through TSA?
I'm not aware of the exact airports, so I don't want to comment on the exact. No, but ideally we'd have a situation where private airlines would be able to contract out to security companies in order to effectively screen passengers before boarding flights.
Just in the last 30 or so seconds we have left, what should people be watching for? What kind of changes in technology, in police practices, that we should be aware of that are going to affect our lives over the next couple of years?
I suppose I'm not a prophet, but I would say the top three facial recognition drones, body cameras. I think we're going to see facial recognition on drones and body cameras, and I think we're going to see body cameras and drones proliferate across the country. So if they're not already, they'll be coming to a city near you, and be aware of that.
And we want police wearing body cameras so that when they misbehave, that's recorded. So it's sort of a double-edged sword.
I think body cameras are good if they're governed by the right policies. With the bad policies, they're a tool of surveillance. So they're not a good in and of themselves. But with the right policies, I share your optimism.
Well, Matthew Feeney, thank you for your time today. We're at the Cato Institute, as I mentioned, and it's always a pleasure to be here talking to you and your colleagues.
The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit BeringDrift.com.
As The Score was being recorded this week, CNN went to court to sue President Trump in an effort to force the White House to reinstate Jim Acosta's credentials. A few years ago, I had an opportunity to interview another political journalist, Sid Davis, who was a witness to John F. Kennedy's assassination and covered the politics beat for four decades. If you look closely at that famous photograph of Lyndon Johnson taking the oath of office on Air Force One, you can see Sid Davis behind Jackie Kennedy, just off to the right. From the archives, here's Sid Davis in October 2014. Sid Davis, you covered the White House in the early 1960s, 40-year career in journalism. What's your assessment of the difference between political coverage today and what it was like 50 years ago?
Well, I think it's looser. I'm not so sure it's as accurate as it used to be. I think there's more opinion today in the news than there was then. I think with cable and the Internet, I think it's pretty broad coverage. But I'm not sure of the accuracy, especially on the Internet, where I'm not sure they have the editing that they would have in a solid network news operation.
Do you think that the concentration of the media back in the early 60s, three networks, just a few leading newspapers, made a difference in the quality of the coverage compared to the much broader situation we've got today?
The
much broader situation we have today with so many cable stations?
Well, I would like to say the broadness has improved it, but I'm not sure it has. I watch cable. I watch some of the hosts on cable where they ask the questions, they answer the questions.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure necessarily that the quality of the journalism is as good as it used to be, because I think that we've lost a lot of talent in the managerial side of the business, and I think that that's a real serious problem.
What about the kind of citizen journalism that takes place on the Internet in the sense?
Well, it's okay with me, but I'm not sure of the facts. I'm not sure who's editing it.
Yeah, there was a lot of stuff back then that didn't get covered, you know, John F. Kennedy's philandering.
I think the fact that it's broader and wider is very good, mm-hmm. but I think there's a responsibility to make sure what they're saying is true, and the Internet is somebody called it an unweeded garden. You know, you can go for broke on the thing, and the facts are not always what they say they are.
Let me ask you about
too much opinion. I think that's the problem.
Too much opinion, not enough facts. Is that
I think so.
Let me ask you about the topic of today, the 1964 campaign. Were you at both of the political conventions that
year? Yes, I was.
And how would you describe the atmosphere at the Republican
convention? The Republican convention was very angry. I mean, Goldwater had an angry tone. They were splitting the party with the moderates. You had Governor Rockefeller there. You had Scranton of Pennsylvania were on the other side. They were liberals, and the conservatives rather threw them out of the temple, so to speak. And that's, as Larry said tonight, that was the beginning of the hard conservative wing of the Republican Party.
What was the Democratic convention like that year?
Well, I was in 64 in Atlantic City.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they were pretty much unified. They lost Jack Kennedy, but Johnson, I think Johnson was accepted widely at the convention. Hubert Humphrey was accepted as vice presidential candidate. It was fantastic. But it was a big difference between the two. The Democrats were totally unified, and the Republicans were not.
You mentioned that you followed Lady Bird Johnson on her whistle-stop tour.
No, I didn't. I was not with her on the whistle-stop, no.
Okay.
I met her in New Orleans where she arrived.
I see. Yeah. Were you on the campaign trail a lot that year?
Yeah, yes, I was.
And what did you see in terms of the president being greeted by crowds?
Big. The crowds were enormous.
Mm-hmm.
And he got out of the car and greeted them all over. He gave the Secret Service some fits because we just had an assassination the year before. But he had a terrific turnouts wherever he went.
Do you think, absent the Kennedy assassination, that Lyndon Johnson could ever have been elected president on his own?
I couldn't make the guess. I don't know. if Kennedy, I'm not even sure Kennedy would have gotten a second term.
Do you think Goldwater could have beat Kennedy?
I don't know. I think that Kennedy might have had a harder time for a second term than he did with a first term.
That's all the time we have for The Score this week. Look for a special edition on the Bering Drift website on Thursday, but be sure to come back next weekend to hear more news, reviews, and interviews. For all the editors and writers at Bering Drift, I'm Rick Sincere. We'll be waiting for you next week.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.